Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. I'm here with Mike Murphy. We'll see temperatures slowly rising this week, although nights should stay comfortable. Today will be sunny with high near 89, dropping to a comfortable 68 degrees at night. A chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, otherwise sunny part of the day, near 91 degrees. By night, it should be clear skies through Wednesday at 93 degrees, although with a chance of showers and thunderstorms at night. Thursday night through Friday, the sun should return on Friday with sunny skies through the rest of the weekend, with days in the low 90s and the nights in the 60s. Now here is Mr. Dennis Hart with the news, and welcome back to Ames, Dennis.
The coronavirus, a ransomware attack against meat producers in Iowa, and a new warden for the Anamosa State Penitentiary all made big news around the state last week. First, the coronavirus. The death toll from the virus in Iowa went up slowly to 6,072 by yesterday, and the number of people infected by the virus also slowly climbed, approaching 402,500 by yesterday. And there was word that Iowa had finished the month of May with fewer than 100 people hospitalized with the coronavirus, the fewest number in nearly 14 months. The last time there were so few hospitalized with the virus was on April 14, 2020. State Department of Public Health Director Kelly Garcia said, in her words, having fewer than 100 Iowans hospitalized with COVID-19 is a significant milestone and a true signal that we are on the right path. At the same time, the Washington Post reported last week that the number of coronavirus vaccinations in Iowa had dropped by 32% over the previous week. 44% of the state's population is now fully vaccinated, which ranks 18th among all 50 states. Governor Reynolds said she's pleased with Iowa's current state of vaccinations and that she will not move to create a lottery to encourage residents to get vaccinated. She said, in her words, "We're still doing everything we can. We're working with every venue we can." Meanwhile, Iowa Auditor Rob Sand alleged last week that the governor had violated the state's self-promotion law by appearing in a video to promote mask wearing during the pandemic. The governor responded by saying the public awareness campaign fell under the law's exemption for disaster emergencies. There was also word that a state judge had ruled that an Iowa woman who had contracted the coronavirus while she was working in a treatment facility where residents ignored face mask requirements is not entitled to state jobless benefits. The judge said Erin Phillips was not entitled to jobless benefits because she had voluntarily quit her job. There was more last week, including word that operations at an Ottumwa pork plant and a Marshalltown pork plant were temporarily halted because of a ransomware attack targeting meat processor JBS. The company's Ottumwa plant stopped its slaughtering line on Tuesday. JBS had told the U.S. government that a criminal organization likely based in Russia had hacked its computers. By the end of the day on Tuesday, JBS confirmed that it had closed all 9 of its U.S. beef plants in the wake of the attack. In Des Moines last week, word that what was described as a security incident prompted the Des Moines Area Community College to shut down parts of its network and caused the entire college to close this past Friday. All online courses went dark on Thursday, and the full college closed Friday. This after another major outage took place last week, that one at the state-owned Iowa Communications Network. That outage resulted in some state of Iowa websites to be affected. On the political front last week, word that lawmakers in the state of Nevada had passed a bill that seeks to place that state's presidential nominating event ahead of both Iowa's caucuses and New Hampshire's primaries. The Nevada legislature approved a bill transforming Nevada's caucuses into primary elections and setting their date early in the year in an effort to supersede both Iowa and New Hampshire. The bill would need support from the national political parties. Meanwhile, Governor Reynolds brushed aside speculation last week that she might run for the U.S. Senate. Reynolds said, in her words, "I'm not leaving Iowa," and hinted that she will soon announce her re-election bid for governor. She said, again in her words, "I'm not done with what I want to do. I love this state, and so I want to stay in the state." The governor has been generating national attention in recent weeks as she carves out a place among the nation's governors as one of the most aggressively focused on returning operations and policies to their pre-coronavirus norms. Also last week, word that the top Democrat in the Iowa State House would step down from his leadership role. Representative Todd Pritchard of Charles City said he's leaving his role as House Minority Leader. He's been in the House of Representatives since 2013 and was elected to lead the Democrats in the House after the 2018 election. He said he will serve out his term as a state representative, but did not say whether he intends to seek re-election next year. House Democrats will hold an election to choose a new leader next Monday. There was also word that Iowa's top environmental leader had rejected a request to review a controversial animal feeding project in northeast Iowa that critics say threatens one of the state's outstanding waterways. Kayla Lyon, the director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources, said she does not have the authority to review the Supreme Beef Project, which is an 11,600-head cattle operation in Clayton County. That operation sits near the headwaters of Bloody Run Creek, a cold-water trout stream that's one of 34 waterways and lakes designated as Outstanding Iowa Waters. In another story, word that companies in Iowa and Texas plan to build pipelines across the state that will capture carbon dioxide emissions from ethanol, fertilizer, and other industrial plants. The companies want to capture the carbon dioxide emissions before they're released into the atmosphere and contribute to global warming, compressing those emissions into a liquid so it can be transported and injected into underground rock formations. There was also a report that POET, a Sioux Falls-based producer of biofuels, had acquired the bioethanol assets of Flint Hills Resources of Kansas. That expands POET's production capacity by 40%, or about 3 billion gallons a year. The acquisition includes 6 bioprocessing facilities in Iowa and Nebraska. And there was word last week that the Iowa prison where 2 employees were killed in March will now be run by a man who spent years providing security for the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. Chris Carberg will take over as the new warden of the maximum security Anamosa State Penitentiary. After his time in Afghanistan, Carberg worked as the assistant warden at a prison in South Dakota. In other news last week, a judge turned down a motion for a mistrial in the murder conviction of Christian Bahena Rivera in connection with the death of University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. Bahena Rivera's lawyers had requested the mistrial after learning that a witness for the prosecution had viewed the live stream coverage of the trial. The judge said that no party had sought to sequester the jury and that no prejudice had resulted from the witness viewing the live stream. Also last week, word that Polk County supervisors had agreed to pay a $200,000 settlement to a man who said he was turned down for a job with the county medical examiner's office because of his sexual orientation. In a lawsuit last year, James Sargent had said that in a recording of county employees making the decision not to hire him, they mocked him because they said he was a member of a gay club. A county supervisor said the case may have been related to the firings last February of the former longtime county medical examiner and the chief medical death investigator in his office. Meanwhile, there was word that Iowa's sex offender treatment facility is facing questions over falsified time card records said to have netted an employee and her husband more than $52,000 in unearned income. No criminal charges have been filed. The Civil Commitment Unit for Sexual Offenders in Cherokee holds up to 150 sexually violent predators who have served out their criminal sentences, but who have been ordered held for treatment until a court determines they are not likely to commit future sexual violence. There was also word last week that the former Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management Director will be the next Public Works Director of Greeley, Colorado. Paul Trombino resigned from his Iowa position last month, only weeks after becoming the state's Emergency Management Director. In Indianola last week, Police Chief Dave Button announced he would retire next month after 8 years as chief. Prior to taking over the Indianola PD, Button spent 28 years as an Iowa State Patrol Trooper and as the Assistant Director of the State Department of Public Safety's Division of Criminal Investigation. Also last week, word that the State Court of Appeals would hear arguments this month about the fairness of a judge who shut down Eastern Iowa's Cricket Hollow Zoo after the judge cited deplorable conditions at the roadside attraction. The owners of the now-closed zoo are appealing a 2019 court decision declaring the zoo to be a public nuisance. Lawyers for the owners say the trial judge took an advocacy role on the side of the animal rights groups that had sued to close the zoo by praising the group's witnesses, criticizing and arguing with the owners and their witnesses. In Des Moines last week, word that for the second time this year, the school board had rejected bids on its shared stadium project with Drake University. The stadium is slated to be built next to the Knapp Center, but the district again rejected the bids because they came in too high. Meanwhile, the legal counsel for the State Board of Regents said last week that once required free speech training is available for state university campuses, it would probably not initially be a penalty for not completing the training. The approved policies stipulate that each university will be required to provide training on free speech to all students, faculty, and staff each year, and penalties will be imposed on faculty members and schools who infringe on a student's right to free expression. There was more last week, including word that the former chief executive officer of Make-A-Wish Iowa pleaded guilty to charges of embezzling thousands of dollars from the charity that supports sick children and their families. Jennifer Woodley admitted in a guilty plea that she had made unauthorized charges on a foundation credit card, given herself an unapproved bonus and salary hikes, and made false entries into foundation records related to those expenses. Under a plea agreement, prosecutors will recommend a sentence of 5 years probation, along with fines and restitution. And one more note before I go, word that the Iowa Lottery is experimenting with 2 of its hallmark games. The Lucky for Life game will have daily drawings starting next month, instead of the current Monday and Thursday draws. And Powerball will start holding a 3rd weekly drawing starting Mondays in late August, instead of the current Wednesday and Saturday draws. Why the changes? because some lotto drawings have been struggling during the coronavirus pandemic, and the lottery is trying to gain new attention. And that is your summary of quite a week of news from all around the state. I'm Dennis Hart, reporting today from Ames, and planning to make a return visit tonight at 7, live on KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin, when we'll talk about what's been making news under the Gold Dome and what it means for all of us. Then I'll come right back here to Local Talk on Friday, when I'll report on what's been making news in Ames. Between now and all that, I hope you have a great week.
My way in North Carolina, staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers, and I'm hoping for Riley I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, I pick a banjo now. Oh, North Country winters keep a getting me down. Lost my money playing poker, so I had to leave town. But I ain't a turning back to living that old life no more. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me. But he's headed west from the Cumberland Gap to Johnson City, Tennessee. I gotta move on before the sun. I hear my baby calling my name, and I know that she's the only one. And if I die in Raleigh, at least I will die free. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock. Hey, hey, mama, rock me. Oh,
And that was Wagon Wheel, sung by Darius Rucker, in keeping with celebrating Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. One of my favorite songs written by Bob Dylan, especially this version by Mr. Rucker. What a voice. Some people call this the Southern Anthem. I always called it the Hitchhiker's Anthem. Anyway, Art Walk happened last Thursday in downtown Ames, and it was a real celebration of coming back to life in Ames. Lots of people were out enjoying being out in public and having fun. It was kind of felt like a coming out for the community on a new level, and it was really fun. Cleora Stanley was the artist who KHOI hosted. She was super sweet and fun to meet, and here's just a few words from Cleora. So tell us how the evening went.
I think it went overall well. I sold a painting today. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Here at Art Walk?
Yeah, I sold it here at Art Walk. It was the piece titled Cheerleader. There was a lady, she was really inspired and taken by the piece, and she said she's going to hang it in her yoga studio.
Tell us what the piece looked like.
I'm from Chicago, so it reminds me of graffiti art. It's two women in the painting, one defeated and one with confidence. And in her brain, you see a cheerleader rooting her on. My cousin is very supportive with everyone in the family, and she says her motto is, sometimes you have to be your own cheerleader. So I entitled it after her. So, yeah, be your own cheerleader.
Cleora Stanley.
Yeah.
And you're a painter.
I am a painter, yes. Mm-hmm. Emerging and painter.
You're an emerging artist.
I am, yes. Yes, I come from a long line of Stanleys who are artists. Very skillful in painting, drafting, writing, poetry, you name it, they could do it.
So talk a little bit about your work. What do you do?
I'm really into abstract art. I'm really into a lot of vibrant colors.
And you live in?
I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois, but I've been living in Des Moines for 4 years now, 4.5 years now, teaching. I also teach preschool.
Very nice. Do you like Des Moines?
I do. It's different. It's a different pace, but lots of creativity, lots of quietness to be able to create. So I do.
How did you get hooked up with Art Walk?
Actually, I went on Facebook, and it popped up in a bunch of events happening around town, and I clicked on it and read about it, and I said, that seems pretty interesting for first getting it out there. So, yeah, I did apply. I corresponded with Sarah.
The Ames Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, and we communicated back and forth via email, and she paired me with the radio station, KHOI.
So did you enjoy this evening?
I did, very much so. Mm-hmm. It was a great night to host the event.
In front of KHOI, we set up a tent here.
Really good weather.
Okay, did you like Ames?
I do, and I will be here for the farmer's market. So.
Okay, so your artist statement as our featured artist here on Art Walk.
I would say be your own kind of artist. Everyone's an artist. You just have to figure out your brushes, your colors, and your canvas to create.
Cleora Stanley, thank you so much for being here at KHOI today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for hosting me. Okay. I enjoyed it.
That was Cleora Stanley, our artist for Art Walk, and a new convert to the city of Ames. She'd never been here before, and I guess in the area of promoting a community, that's how it's done. And this is Local Talk. I'm your Monday local host, Ursula Rudenberg. And speaking of the end of cabin fever and the return of the arts, Kids Commotion Ames Local Dance Company will offer a 3-week modern dance workshop for children starting next Saturday. Valerie Williams, director of Commotion, is here. And with her is Danny Steffs, who is design intern, and Elise Cameron. Welcome to Local Talk.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And Kids Commotion starts in July.
Oh, I thought it was starting this June. So it's starting in July. Oh,
right.
Good. Okay. So there's much more time to sign up.
Yes. Yes. And we love that. At any rate, Kids Commotion always runs the last 3 full weeks in July.
Okay. Great.
So the actual dates depend on the year. This year, we are July 12th through the 30th for the workshop. We meet Monday through Friday from 10 to 2:30 each day. So it's lots of dancing. We start with an hour of technique, and then we do composition and improvisation. And then we have a little lunch break, and then we spend 2 hours rehearsing.
And this is something that you've done for many years, right?
started in 1989, and we have been continuously producing concerts and workshops for kids in Ames ages 8 to 18, which makes it actually pretty unique among arts organizations because we mix a really wide variety of ages. Yeah. That works fabulously well. It's really amazing.
What makes it work so well?
We have at least a 50% return rate each year, and the kids who come back bring their skills with them, especially their compositional skills and the things that they have learned. So the kids who are younger or just starting don't just step up in knowledge and experience. They take that experience from the older kids and they leap up. So the work that the kids produce is really pretty amazingly high level.
Wow. So it's like a culture with many generations in it.
It is. It's also really interesting how well the kids get along. I mean, an 8-year-old and a 17-year-old, you wouldn't think that they would have very much in common. But when they have to work together to produce dance, they have something in common. Everybody is expected to contribute ideas. We base our dances around a central theme. So instead of it being a recital, which is what you usually see kids do, and there's nothing wrong with a recital. I mean, a recital shows everybody what we've learned this last year. But instead of just doing a recital, we do a concert of dances where the students create dances and they learn dances that I choreograph based on a theme. And this year, our theme is bubbles. I like to choose themes that can be looked at in lots of different ways. And in the past, we have done themes that are, I'll say, a little bit more concrete and some that are more abstract. So the concrete ones are like when we did the Ring of the Nibelungen and we tell stories. And this year, though, I was just interested in being abstract again with this idea of bubbles that we've all gone through over the last year. The bubbles of our pods, of our families, those bubbles of our relationships. But also the physics of bubbles. How do bubbles work? And what bubbles look like? The iridescence of a bubble. And then just the whole sense of spheres and small spheres like marbles and things that we can do with those small spheres, big spheres. So I am working right now on a 36-inch balloon. But we can't just have a balloon. So I've made this cover for a 36-inch balloon that we're going to be using. So we've got lots of ideas. And then those are just the ideas that we have come up with in the office. The kids will have ideas also. I always say we start out with 87 ideas and we have to narrow that down to the 7 or 8 that we actually can develop and perform. And this is something different about Kids Co-Motion also. That we develop ideas. So this isn't like a 90-second, so you think you can dance kind of dance where we just show everything that we can do physically with our bodies and then we stop. We really expect the students and ourselves too, as choreographers, to develop ideas so that they become concert dances rather than just a little, let me show you how high I can kick my leg dance.
Sounds like that you're also creating choreographers.
We are definitely creating choreographers. And actually, we do technique class because that's what dancers do. So the students really behave like professional dancers. And I understand that they are not professional dancers, but the expectation is that that's how they will behave. And we have found that that's then what they do. They work in a really disciplined, joyful way that includes everybody's ideas. But we also look at those ideas every day. So they get really positive, constructive criticism about their dances every day. So then they can make a choice. Do I keep this direction that my dance is going? Or because I've shown it and people asked lots of questions about what we were doing, are we being clear with our communication? So they essentially have lots and lots of directors and they learn to work in that really collaborative way that doesn't just serve them well in dance, but really serves them well in their rest of their lives.
So this is our own dance company here in Central Iowa.
Well, Co-Motion Dance Theater is a professional modern dance company, and we toured throughout the upper Midwest for 35, 40 years. And during the pandemic, we stopped touring. And we also stopped, I'm going to say, I retired from producing concerts, a regular concert series, which I actually did right before the pandemic. So it was serendipitous for us. So we are still making dances, but we're not working. However, our outreach projects, Kids Co-Motion and Women in Motion, are continuing.
You did take a hiatus last year, right? You didn't do the workshop last summer?
I was thinking maybe you should take a hiatus this year. And I talked with a number of parents who said, no, please, please, let's have Kids Co-Motion. So we had a very small group of kids. We had 12 kids, and we did not advertise. We were socially distanced. We wore masks, and we met outside in a park. We met for a shorter amount of time, which it turned out the kids could have met for the entire 4.5 hours instead of the 3 hours that we met. And we worked with some computer, I'm not going to say aided dance, but we did a lot of video recording of us dancing. The kids did the recordings, and then they arranged those dances for the camera. But we also did site-specific dances outside without touching, which I have to tell you just about killed us.
And are the recordings of these available to watch?
No, actually they're not. Uh-huh. And I should see if we can't put them up online.
Yeah, it's kind of a historical documents now, aren't they?
They are. And we don't usually put them up. I mean, we did put them on Ames Public Access Television for a long time, but we don't just put them up willy-nilly because of music rights when we use other people's music. Yeah. Kids Co-Motion has in the past really, I mean, since 2010, we have worked with live music as often as we can. Yeah, it was our 25th, or I can't remember what year it was. It was 2006 when we worked with a band on stage. But last year, of course, we didn't do that. And we won't be this year either, because we will be working outside again. And then we will move into the city auditorium again next year. But this year, enough people were still nervous about meeting in groups, and that we decided
to stay outside.
We're going to stay outside, and we'll be performing at the band show. So we will have a stage this year to dance on, which the kids really missed. They missed having that fully produced concert, because one of the other things Kids Co-Motion does is train kids in how we move from an idea into movement, and then how that gets put on a stage with lighting and costumes. And they really go through the entire process of making a concert in 3 weeks' time.
If somebody has a child who is not really young, who's, say, maybe in the mid-range, a young teenager, but has no experience so far, can they jump in at any point?
Or do they can jump in.
Okay. So tell us again about how to sign up for this. And again, this starts July 12th.
Yes.
And it goes for 3 weeks, right? And it's an every day during the week type of thing, right?
Yes. And then we culminate that in two performances on July, and those will be in the evening, July 30th and 31st. So people can go to www.comotion.org. That's comotion.org. And see more information and sign up.
Okay,
they can
register
at that. Then there's a nice little button that says register here.
We have to end the conversation, but your intern is there, Danny Steffes. Any last words, Danny, before I'll give you the last word before we end the interview. What do you have to say about the workshop?
This is my first year doing it, and I'm just so excited to see all these kids create and perform, so I can't wait for it.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking with Danny Steffes, who is an intern with Co-Motion, and with Valerie Williams, director of Co-Motion, and this is the Co-Motion Kids Workshop. Thank you so much, Valerie. And again, just give the website one more time before you leave.
www.comotion.org. comotion.org. That's comotion.org.
Okay. Thank you so much. And that'll start July 12th. This is Local Talk. I'm your Monday Local Talk host, Ursula Rudenberg. I'm here with engineer Mike Murphy. And Iowa's Resource for International Services, or IRIS, is a nonprofit, non-religious organization headquartered in Ames that works to promote international education, development, and peace through people-to-people exchange program that develop and enhance citizen diplomacy. They conduct programs which bring students, journalists, business people, and educators and government leaders to Iowa from throughout the world to live temporarily, to build friendships and understanding, and adjusting to pandemic times. This has also taken interesting virtual forms in recent times. Full disclosure, I'm a board member, actually, at IRIS, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dale Christensen here for a brief conversation. He's the executive director of IRIS. Dale, tell us a little bit about hosting the Iraqi youth program that is currently underway.
As most everybody has figured out over the last year, it's been a challenge to flex virtual aspects of your work. And that especially takes interesting form when you're working with international groups, because we can't just jump right back into the person-to-person if everything in the U.S. is looking better. We have to also have everything in every other country that we work in also looking better. So we're still working a little bit on the virtual program. We had a virtual high school exchange program this spring with 10 students from 8 different countries. And we have one last virtual program, we're hoping, before we go back into in-person, person-to-person citizen diplomacy. And that's a group of high school students from Iraq who will be connecting with us virtually July 5th through the 18th. And they'll be here on a youth, they'll be meeting with us with a youth leadership program. So we'll be doing youth leadership training with them. They will still be having a virtual host family, because we still feel that that host family experience is so key to citizen diplomacy around the world.
It's kind of the cornerstone, right?
It is. It is. Bringing people to your home, whether it's in person or virtually, makes that connection, and you realize you have many more similarities than differences.
So how does a virtual family work in a situation like this? I mean, you get together once a day by Zoom, or how? What is a virtual family?
Yeah, it's we work with a lot of different platforms, whether it's Zoom or Telegram or Viber or WhatsApp, any of the international connecting platforms that are out there. And we really leave it up to the virtual host families, just as we do with in-person hosting, for them to come up with what they would like to do to share about their family, their culture, their communities with our international guests. And so a lot of times I fully expect this group of virtual host families for our Iraqi students to be taking them on a virtual tour of the farmer's market, get a chance to do a virtual cooking demonstration back and forth in their kitchens, their mutual kitchens. And so the Iraqi students and their families will get a chance to share some of their cooking.
You know, what's interesting about that is, in speaking with some of the alumni of this program, the parents of the young person who are left behind in the mother country, so to speak, they don't really experience what happens when this young person comes to Iowa and, you know, spends a year and some, you know, travels from South Africa to some small town in Iowa and goes to high school there, and a whole other relationships gets developed with this other set of kind of host parents. And, you know, the people I've talked to, they've really expressed that it's changed, you know, this year has changed them. And then when they go back, they have to kind of explain to their real parents who they are now. But this is very different, right? Because the parents have the opportunity to be part of the experience, right?
Yes, it really is. It really is. Now,
so it's more like a family exchange.
Yeah. With technology, we've been able to expand that connectivity. But yeah, for a lot of the natural parents back in their country, they're just going on faith that the students are going to be well cared for, and they connect with families from time to time, but nothing is as close as the way we have it with the virtual program. So that's a nice aspect of that.
With these cooking demonstrations and things like that, the parents are there as well, right?
Yeah, so the parents both back in Iraq as well as the parents here in the U.S. would be sharing recipes with each other and showing what the cooking is. The only downside of virtual is you don't get the taste test. So
that's true. Yeah, that's true. And I'm sure there's lots of good food to be tried in a case like that. So what exactly is the youth leadership program then? Like what is that part of it?
We were fortunate that in 2019, we were able to do an in-person version of the Iraqi Young Leaders Exchange Program. It's a program that's been funded by the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad to encourage young people from Iraq to develop leadership skills from their American counterparts and take those leadership skills and create volunteer projects in their home communities. So we do a series of leadership training programs, and then we combine that with some cultural activities and just encourage them to develop strategies that in the long run, they will do great things in their home country.
What kind of things do they volunteer for?
In their own country, it runs the gamut of environmental programs, environmental cleanup programs in their communities, health programs, whether it's education for young girls on health issues. We've had students that have developed CPR training programs in other countries, in their country. Environmental cleanup has been everything from tree planting programs to clean water programs to wildlife habitat restoration. So we've been really impressed with what the students come up with, because like everything else, we can provide some skill sets, but it really is the participants from those countries who know best what their country needs and what their community needs.
It's very interesting. I'm sure we learned a lot about Iraq, too, through this. So before you go, Del, you have your yearly event coming up, which is every year IRIS does Peace Day, a 5 and 10K race, and an international festival, which is kind of introduces people to many different cultures, and it's going to be in September. And you're looking for businesses who are interested in sponsoring this event, right?
Yes, we always do this annual event around the week of the UN's International Day of Peace, which for the UN is September 21st. This year, our scheduled event is going to be Sunday, September 19th at Raccoon River Park in West Des Moines. And we do a Peace Day 5K, 10K fun walk run that people can just take part in, enjoy the day. But we also have international groups from throughout Iowa that come in and set up displays and have booths and just sharing culture. So we are still looking for a handful of sponsors for those programs. We're looking at sponsorship of $250 each. So if you as an individual or your business is interested in sponsoring the Peace Day event and international festival, you can contact me directly at 515-971-0953, or you can email us at info@iris-center.org. So it's iris-center.org.
And give the website.
And our website is www.iris-center.org. So www.iris-center.org.
Okay. And we'll put a link to that on our website as well. Thank you, Del.
Great.
It's a really...
Thank you, Ursula.
This Iraqi exchange sounds really like a refreshing way to kind of come out of the pandemic as well, just connecting virtually. It's really nice.
It is. It is. And we will be posting some of the videos and that from that group on our social media sites as well.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm speaking with Del Christensen, the Executive Director of IRIS, which is Iowa's Resource for International Service, connecting Iowans to the rest of the world. Right, Del?
Right.
Thank connecting you, them to us. Yeah. Thank you.
Exactly.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'd like to spend the last part of this hour on a topic that I've been interested in for quite some time. This topic is Iowa's rest areas on major highways across the state, which seems kind of like out of left field, but it's really one of the things I like best about our home state. when you cross into Iowa on the highway from other states, the rest areas suddenly become noticeably more interesting. I was visiting a few years ago with the manager of the rest area on 35, just south of the Minnesota border, otherwise known as Top of Iowa Welcome Center. And I asked her who or what is behind making Iowa's rest areas exceptional. And she said, oh, that would be Steve McKemmenen, who is down at the DOT in Ames. So she said, talk to him. So I bring you Steve McKemmenen, who is Iowa's rest area administrator for the Department of Transportation. And I hope you'll enjoy learning a little bit about what's behind Iowa's impressive rest areas. I certainly did. We have 38 rest areas in Iowa on Interstate Highways 35 and 80 and Highway 29, which is going up north-south in the western side of Iowa, and 380, which is a north-south highway in eastern Iowa. Those are full-service rest areas. And then we have other areas that are parking areas, right?
15 of those around the state.
I just want to review what seem to be the general services at these rest stops. You have vending machines, wireless internet, stands outside of the building, so you can access it in your car. It seems like a lot of them have baby changing areas. They're all wheelchair accessible. I'm assuming they all have restrooms and water available. And then something called weather monitors.
Those were information kiosks that we had at all 40 buildings years ago. Initially, that was just to provide weather information. It was a screen. And then we expanded that to include construction activities, tourist information, other things on a monitor inside the building. But that technology, although it was cutting edge 20 years ago, you have on your phone everything that's on that monitor. So we're phasing those out, putting up big TV monitors in all these buildings, and then we'll decide what that playlist has on there from, you know, weather cameras, public information messages, but there'll be no audio, not hands-on. It's just going to be a playlist that will run through like a screensaver.
Will that also be an emergency alert system if there's emergency?
Yeah, they all have separate IP address, so the messages could be different from one side of the road to the other. Like when we close I-35 in the winter, you know, that'll be on the northbound signs. And whatever happens, or even an accident that has traffic backed up.
And an adult changing station, what is that?
All those newer, bigger buildings have what's called a family room.
It's a separate bathroom for people traveling, might need help with each other going to the restroom, or parents traveling with young kids that don't want to send them into a public restroom. The private room that has a diaper changing station in there, all ADA compliant. We are currently working on a request from people that need an adult changing station in there, which will be a table that is electronic, that can go various heights. They can put
adults or larger children that need
assistance.
It's not a huge population, but there's these people that are traveling.
But it really means a lot to a lot of people.
That's right. There's a need out there. They're a little pricey, but it's being well received. You ought to see the group that we met with, and they just broke into tears when we tell them we're going to put in something for them so they didn't have to change their kids on the floor of a C-store or something, you know. You know, you're starting to see that in maybe some of the airports. Not a lot of it. And actually, I think, you know, when we get this started, I think you'll see this take off.
Well, one of the things I'm getting from talking to you is that the DOT is listening to changing needs of people using highways, right?
Correct.
Okay, so now I've been in other states where rest areas are all the same. It's the same building. It's the same set of amenities. It's a simple outlay that has no individual characteristics. But when you come into Iowa, the rest stops are a lovely nicety about being in the state. Do you have a template for the buildings, or is each building designed uniquely to the spot?
In the mid-90s, we decided it was time to start to replace these old buildings like you're talking about. They all looked identical. They were pretty industrial-looking, solid buildings, but they were never intended for the kind of traffic we had. And so in the mid-90s, we started a program called the Next Generation or New Generation of Rest Areas in Iowa.
So are you the person who manages that and kind of leads those individual projects?
Well, I administer all the building projects. I was involved in the initial prototype building, me and another guy that's since retired, and we developed three prototype buildings with the help of an architect and some of us at the DOT. But they're different sizes, small, medium, and large. Basically, the building looks the same, but we brought in the public artists and let them have some say on what it really looks like. And the public artist, who typically is the one who puts the concept together, the idea behind what they're going to build. Even though the footprint is the same, the building can be different colors, different materials. There can be art that is integrated into the building, things on the floor. There can be wall murals, statues, and things that tell the history of Iowa in that area. And that has been extremely popular as well. And
who's that public artist? How do you find that person?
We've only dealt with four same public artists out of Des Moines. David Dahlquist did a lot of the early buildings, and we met with him and kind of talked with him about what we think is okay and what we don't think was okay. And I work with a bunch of engineers and artists. That's apples and oranges. But in Iowa, we had to be fairly conservative, and it had to be safe. It's got to be durable. You know, there's 17 million people that use the rest areas, and not everybody's really nice to things, you know. But to be quite honest, once we put those new buildings up in Iowa, we've been really fortunate not to have hardly any vandalism in any of the buildings, really.
Mm-hmm.
Tell that to some states, they wouldn't believe you.
Yeah, no.
And we make sure that everything is working.
Do you believe that the artwork helps protect them from vandalism?
I think it does, because people like what they see. I can't tell you, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of compliments we've gotten on those art features, and people will learn something about the state. I've even had people plan their vacation to go to these 20 sites to look at that stuff.
Really? People plan their vacations for the rest areas?
Yeah, and outdoor teaching projects for schools. Yeah, I don't know how many times I've talked to schools, I think maybe like fifth or sixth grade when they do Iowa history, go out and meet them at some of these sites and explain to them, you know, the Underground Railroad in Cedar County is real popular with classrooms. And so it's an educational tool for teachers. And it gets the kids outside for, you know, half a day, and they have lunch and stuff, ask questions. And
it's very nice.
And Cedar County is about the Underground Railroad. The one in Sioux City is about the Lewis and Clark Expedition. The one at Dowse is the Civil War involvement with Iowa people. Iowa is unique enough that you can about find something in every county that you could pick up on and build on. It's nice to have a little bit of Iowa history involved in all that. It's all unique. We like to make an integral part of the buildings. Like at Dow's up there, they look like shells from a gun, but they're actually bollard light, you know, that go across, light up the ground. They use, you know, different trails. They use different murals to paint a picture. In Adair County, we talk about the loss of topsoil with big statues out in front. Story City Southbound is all about transportation. It's about the history of transportation in Iowa. So if you go in that building, you would see the picture we've all seen about Lincoln Way and stuck in the mud down there. And all the different modes of transportation are in and around that building somewhere. So try to get involved in the building, whether it be on the floors, the walls, murals. Cedar Rapids, where it was Grant Wood theme out there, we have the couple that you see with the fork all the time with on his paintings. We use her as a symbol for the women's restroom on the one side and him on the other side. But there's always something that will catch your eye, and you see people stop and turn and go back and taking pictures. You know, once people get there, there's a little something more to do than just go in and use the bathroom and leave. You know, and the longer people stay at a site, the safer they are when they get back out on the interstate. So
part of the idea is to entice people to get some rest, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And pick up a little local history. You know, we involved a public artist in all these designs when we first started this back in the mid-90s, and we wanted to bring out a local theme.
Is Iowa unique in this attention being paid to rest areas?
Yeah. Texas always say they're better than we are because you just have more. You're not any better than we are. And we were real fortunate to have the governor's office supporting this when we started. I mean, they're expensive, but we're seeing how people talked about them, how they call and say, what a great job you're doing, and we're going to make sure we go through Iowa. And so that kind of vision, to come in and put money in rest areas, turns out it really helped the whole DOT. So I'm happy I got to kind of grow up with that.
You are definitely leaving a legacy behind you when you retire.
I have five buildings coming up in the next 5 years. The one in Pacific Junction down in Mills County, that's the Native American Heritage. That'll be really interesting to see when that's done down there. And that should start in July or August.
Where's that going to be?
We call it Pacific Junction Northbound. It's I-29 by Glenwood. First rest area as you come into Iowa from the south. We're getting artwork from a number of different people out there. So that'll be worth seeing sometime. I'll tell you that. That's pretty impressive.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm speaking with Steve McMenamin, who is the rest area administrator for the Department of Transportation. And he's speaking from his office here in Ames, giving us a little bit of an insight into how Iowa ended up with so many charming rest areas. Steve, thank you so much for spending so much time with me. I do want to talk about one more thing with you, though, which is one of my favorite things, the Northwood rest area, the last rest area on I-35, right as you leave Iowa and enter into Minnesota. Minnesota has a rest area on the other side. My apologies to the state of Minnesota, which has a very nice welcome sign, but their rest area really pales in comparison to Iowa's rest area. It's a red barn with two floors in it inside. I talked to the manager a few years ago.
Yeah, Jean Stolwell. She's been there ever since we started.
She said that it was a partnership to build something like that. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
We used to have rest areas at Clear Lake and a small welcome center there and a wastewater system that was in dire need of work. The people from Top of Iowa Welcome Center Board came to us about building a welcome center out on that corner. And we took that and said, okay, let's relocate our rest areas and the welcome center up towards the border where they should be. And then they did the design. We basically let them kind of run with that. We paid for the majority of this in exchange for a long-term maintenance agreement. They take care of that building.
There's a casino built now next to it, so it's difficult to see the rest area because it's overshadowed by this big casino.
Worth County really reaped the benefits of this. That was a cornfield, and we started that up there. And, you know, the casino came after that, the C-store came after that. Two gas stations are there, two motels are there. So that's been a huge development for that part of the state.
And it was triggered by the rest area?
Yep. They wanted a welcome center. We wanted to relocate the rest areas at Clear Lake. It just was kind of a good fit. They had the ground. We didn't have the ground. We had more money than they did. And so that's how that all kind of worked together. And we signed an agreement in 1996. In those days, in the mid-90s, public-private partnership looked like a way to develop rest areas, get the public involved, and help share some of the cost. And that was one of the first in the country that pulled that off. Well, thinking that that was going to be a good way to proceed in the future, we ran into a real problem with the truck stop owners, even the trucking industry, thinking that the state was subsidizing the private sector, and they didn't like that. And so that next session of the legislature, that was passed a bill that says we can't do that anymore.
Mm.
So that's one of a kind, and there's no other development of any kind on our properties now.
I'm looking here at comments written about it, and this one person writes, best rest stop area ever. We stopped at the rest area just to use the bathroom and found the nicest, fanciest, cleanest rest area we've ever seen. 2 exclamation points. There was the sweetest man working in a gift shop who encouraged us to sign the guest book and stop for ice cream at the nearby booth where we also got iced coffee. And there are lots of vending machines and information on Iowa, which we didn't need as we were heading back to Minnesota, but a really nice little stop.
Yeah, we get lots of compliments about that. I remember when we were building that thing, we'd go into Northwood and I couldn't buy lunch. I mean, people would come up to me and so happy about what they were seeing up there. And
the bottom part of it looks kind of like your, you know, usual rest stop. There is a historic section in back, right? There's a historic marker. But then you go up the stairs and there's a ice cream shop, gift shop, little tourist center up there. What's really nice about the gift shop is that it's arts and crafts by Iowa people.
Yeah, it's kind of a consignment area. You could spend an hour there and not feel like you've wasted any time. It's that kind of place. But it has been a great thing, and it's really been a real plus for the state and for the travelers. I still meet with Jean once in a while. We're still friends. So
she's really a hostess for the state of Iowa there.
Yes,
in the West area. She told us that the heating system is geothermal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, the tables look like they're cows.
Yeah, I think they're black and white.
So. Yeah, I'm speaking with Steve McMiniman, who works here in Ames as the rest area administrator for the Department of Transportation, and he's describing the rest areas in Iowa, which have received a unique amount of attention and care. Is there a place where somebody can find out what the different rest stops actually have?
They're on our webpage. Go into rest areas. It'll show you all features are there. It'll have posters and postcards of all those sites that you could look at, just what the theme was, what they looked like, and they're printable PDFs. I've had calls of people saw all the posters on the webpage there. We're making plans to visit every single one of those, spend a week just traveling around in Iowa going on a vacation to see those. Now, I don't know that I would recommend doing that because that's kind of what I do all the time. You know, my job is
that's what you get paid to do.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a long time, and someday I'm going to write a book about this because some of it's pretty funny, some of it's pretty weird. I've seen things I can't unsee.
Give us one preview of something you can't unsee.
Well, let's see. I got to keep it clean here. But one thing I always remember: a guy left his wife at the rest area, and she was left there with a dog. And we didn't get him stopped until Minneapolis when his kids went out and stopped him on the interstate and let him know they left his wife in Dallas 2.5 hours back.
And he didn't notice she wasn't there.
Yeah. My job is.
Okay. Well, so thank you so much for your sharing some of the explanation of how these rest areas are created. Thank you.
You bet. Call anytime.
Okay, I will. Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and that was Steve McMenamin, who is the administrator for the rest stop areas for the Department of Transportation. And thank you for listening and being with us this morning. Also, remember you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoyfm.org with links to the guests and information you heard. Tune in tonight at 7 p.m. for Capital Week with Dennis Hartch and Laura Bellin for an in-depth look at the week's legislative action, government agencies, and other events that affect Iowa government. Local Talk was engineered by Mike Murphy. Thank you, Mike. Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. You also heard Bob Dylan's song, Wagon Wheel, sung by the golden voice of Darius Ruckers. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOY meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.